Recently, I've been making videos about the managerial elite. There have been two so far, the managerial elites and what Marx got right. In this video, I want to explore some of the deeper implications of managerial capitalism. Before doing so, let's recap some of the key ideas we've established so far. First, in Western liberal democracies, managerial elites have established effective control across the government, corporations, and the media. And this is a consequence of mass and scale, which increase demand for the technical skills of managers. In the private sphere, they've achieved this through the phenomenon of dispersed ownership and mass stock holdings, whereby a few key asset management firms, such as the Vanguard Group and BlackRock, now own around 40% of all mass corporations through index and pension funds. Incidentally, it should be noted that although mass corporations are a huge part of the economy, they only account for 0.3% of firms. So anyone looking at top line numbers of total stock holdings would miss this, since the vast majority of stocks are in the 99.7% of small and medium firms, a huge number of which are currently startup IPOs based in Silicon Valley. So looking at top line numbers of this nature obscures what is happening with the ownership of mass corporations we are concerned with here, which are increasingly owned by a mass of people through the diversified portfolios of the aforementioned giant asset management firms. An average school teacher might have some portion of their retirement savings locked up in stocks of McDonald's without even realizing it. Anyway, since the investor class is now largely passive, the traditional relationship between ownership and control has been severed. Even though private investors and the mass of smaller investors, like your teachers and firemen and so on, have ownership of large corporations, they lack the means and the skills to manage them. So effective control is with the managerial class, who have somewhat different incentives from traditional entrepreneur capitalist owners. Where owners are largely concerned with profit, return on investment, managers are largely concerned with growth. Managerial elites have achieved a near total fusion of government and corporations to the extent that distinctions between the public and the private spheres at this level are borderline meaningless. In other words, it doesn't really matter if it is Washington or Google who have oversight of this or that, since the same managerial elites occupy both bodies and push the same interests and values. This renders conventional arguments over state ownership versus private ownership almost entirely redundant. You get the same outcome, the same sorts of people making the decision both ways. Now, in my last video, I suggested that this renders our current system, which we can call managerial capitalism, to be somewhat like the communist regimes we have seen in the past. As one can see from this picture, the managerial class structurally hold an identical position to the commissars in, let's say, Soviet Russia. Some people seem to have misunderstood this point. I was not saying that the managerial class rule in the interests of the people, but quite the opposite. They serve their own interests very largely against the will and the interests of the people they are meant to be working for at all levels. And to be absolutely sure that we are clear, the Soviet commissars also ruled in their own interests against the will and the interests of the vast majority of their supposed comrades. You can call it a dictatorship of the proletariat or liberty and democracy, but these are empty phrases. And just so no one gets confused, I am not for this. I do not support managerial elites or mass corporations. Obviously, I am strongly opposed to this development. I want to expose how it works so we know what we're up against. So with all of this established, let's take a look at another concept that arises from this phenomenon of dispersed ownership, the severing of ownership and control, and the centralization of power in managers. That concept is called dematerialization. It was first outlined by Joseph Schumpeter in 1942. Schumpeter is one of the all-time great economists, and he was Austrian. In fact, he trained in the same class as Ludwig von Mises. But he was not, strictly speaking, quote-unquote, an Austrian economist, which is to say, he is not part of the main line of the Austrian school of economics, but tends to have his own unique take on things. Well, here he is on this. He says, "The capitalist process, by substituting a mere parcel of shares for the walls of and the machines in a factory, takes the life out of the idea of property. It loosens the grip that was once so strong, the grip in the sense of the legal right and the actual ability to do as one pleases with one's own. The grip also in the sense that the holder of the title loses the will to fight, economically, physically, politically, for his factory and his control over it, to die, if necessary, on its steps. Dematerialized, defunctionalized, and absentee ownership does not impress and call forth moral allegiance as the vital form of property did. Eventually, there will be nobody left who really cares to stand for it, nobody within and nobody without the precincts of the big concerns." Now, there are many examples of this, but I'll point to two very visible ones. One is the gap between the Walt Disney Company under actual Walt Disney, the real man and visionary, who was a staunch conservative and a good old-fashioned Southern boy with good old-fashioned values, and the company today, which is an amorphous blob run by politically correct managerial elites, none of whom would shed even a single tear if Disney went under. They just get a job at another mass corporation. I'm also reminded of the gap between Star Wars under the direct control of George Lucas and Star Wars under the control of said managerial elites at Disney. Now, one can say what one wants about the quality of output under Disney himself or under George Lucas himself, but the gap between how they saw their own companies and how managerial elites see them should be striking and obvious. What was once a cherished property in the hands of the managerial elite now comes to stand for an entirely different set of values, entirely co-opted by the moral vision and the global agenda of said elites. And in more recent times, even at the consumer level, we have seen a further dematerialization of property, as many markets have not only digitized, but have also moved to subscription-based models. For example, where we once owned our own records, tapes, or CDs, now people just subscribe to have a huge selection of music on demand from a service like Spotify. But this severs the old property relationship that came with owning things. Now one tends perpetually to rent things rather than owning them outright. Now, even if you buy a physical copy of a game, you're still only buying a license to access the software and not a copy of the thing itself. And of course, in the back end, managerial elites can pick and choose what is and is not on the platform. Anything that violates the vision of the managerial elites is quietly taken off, while anything that furthers the agenda of the elites is pushed. Netflix or BBC, pick your poison. For defenders of the Austrian school of economics, which prizes private property above all else, not to mention anyone who cares about the traditions of liberty in Britain or America, this phenomenon of dematerialization and the undermining of the incentives that come with property ownership presents a significant problem, one that we really must start thinking about carefully. Schumpeter was suggesting that this problem is built into the logic of capitalism itself. Whether that is or is not the case, this is what has happened. As Julius Evola wrote in Men Among the Ruins, Lenin saw clearly through all this and how in such upheavals one of the traits of dying capitalism consists of digging its own grave, being forced by the mechanism it set in motion to unleash through industrialization, proletarianization, and Europeanization, forces that eventually will react against it and against the white man's societies. The representatives of progress are not aware of it, and so the process snowballs. In the socialist system, the claim to be the rightful heirs of a capitalism doomed to perish because of this inner contradiction, the enslavement of the single individual, is reaffirmed, then alleviated. It is sanctioned no longer simply de facto, but de jure as well. In socialist regimes, this enslavement obeys a collective imperative. Evola is saying that the individual worker in capitalism is enslaved not by the fact he must work, but by the fact he is wedded to a model of material consumption. All the socialists do is come along afterwards and set into law a positive right, what was once something that was afforded by the market. We can see this, for example, in the Labour Party's recent attempt to declare broadband internet a human right that should be provided by the state. But the real implications of all this is that we are already a long way on the road to living in something approaching a totalitarian socialist state, only it's under liberal democracy, under managerial capitalism, that has also been called left-wing capitalism. Unfortunately, this means the scale of our struggle is vast. Neither privatization nor nationalization of key resources will matter one jot as long as managerial elites maintain control of the levers of power. Traditional notions of left and right, capitalism versus socialism and so on, mean absolutely nothing in this context. Nothing less than a full revolution of elites at all these levels will change the insane trajectory on which we are currently headed. In a future video, I will outline exactly how the managerial class gained control of the political sphere, but for now, get out.